This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. When gas prices got close to $4 a gallon, how'd you feel about that? When cost at the pump came down some, what was your reaction? Most of us like it when prices go down, not so much when they go up. Simple, huh? But what does that say about the future of green energy? If it were possible to run your car on a more environmentally friendly fuel, would you want to? What if it cost 50% more? What about electricity for your home? Willing to pay extra for wind, solar, or some other non-fossil energy source? Okay, but what if the fuels you're using right now are actually costing you in ways you never even knew? Economist Barclay Rosser has been researching such questions for some time now. He's agreed to fill us in on his findings right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Have any thoughts on the cost of clean energy? Ideas on how much you're willing to pay for it? On what forms of energy production is best or worst? Then we'd love to hear from you this hour as one of our favorite economists takes us through some of his findings about the energy economy. 888-WMRA Talk is how to reach us by phone, 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight. J. Barclay Rosser travels the globe talking to people about the impact of economics. He's just back from a series of conferences in Moscow, so we thought we'd catch him before he jumps back on yet another plane. Dr. Rosser is also professor of economics at James Madison University. Barclay Rosser, welcome back to the Insight Studios.
It's a pleasure to be back, Tom.
So, Barclay, what would be the best source of energy for us to be using to fuel our world?
Well, we've got two main things we have to provide. We have to provide electricity, and we have to provide transportation. And electricity, we use lots of sources, and I would like to see non-polluting or minimum polluting renewable resources as much as possible. It would be wonderful if we could do solar and wind and maybe thorium nuclear and hydro. Each of these has its own problems, but coal is very dirty. Natural gas is very good in the short run and is quite clean, but it still produces greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, but it's quite inexpensive and probably will be what we'll be using for that. On transportation, we, of course, use oil. And if we could get the hybrids or electric cars or some other alternative in the longer run, we might go to hydrogen or some other things. But I think we should be certainly reducing our use of oil, both because in the longer run, it's going to become more expensive, and also it's very polluting in a variety of ways. And those have costs that we're not really paying for at the pump. And when we, you know, pay our electricity bills, and we've got coal-fired sources of electricity, we're not really paying the full cost of that either in terms of...
Tell me more about not really paying the cost either for gasoline at the pump or for coal-fired electricity at home.
Well, part of this is, of course, that in fact we do have subsidies for fossil fuels. We have long subsidized the highway system. We have price supports in agriculture. For years and years, we had tax breaks for the oil industry. This is called depletion allowance. There have been many, many subsidies, not many of which are very public. So those in effect, favored fossil fuels. The fossil fuels have multiple pollutants. Now, some of those we are, you know, covering the cost of. So sulfur dioxide is a very serious pollutant from coal, and we've spent quite a bit of money to get that under control. But a very big one, and this also applies to natural gas, although it's better, is carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. Now, there are debates about what is directly the human input, but most scientists, in fact, think that we are contributing to global warming and that this is going to be an increasingly serious problem in the future. And in another way, I think we're not really worrying about the future too much. So people are looking in very short-sighted. They're not looking at the effect on 100 years from now or future generations on what we're doing now. You put that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it doesn't go away very quickly. So we're pumping stuff up there that's going to be around 100, 200 years from now, and we're not paying for it.
So, Barclay, You gave us two sides. One, and I guess whenever we think of energy, we should think of two sides. One is what fuels transportation for the most part. The other is what fuels industry and puts our lights on at home.
Right.
But let's stick with cars and and vehicles on the road for a moment. When you say we're not really paying the costs or there are costs beyond what we see, are you saying, for example, when you talk about subsidies, that if there had not been years and decades of oil production subsidies, that the cost we would be paying at the pump would be considerably higher than it is now?
Probably. But we would have paid higher prices for years. I mean, we have for decades paid much lower prices for gasoline than are paid in most of the rest of the world.
So, and then in terms of other kinds of hidden costs, are you talking about maybe the health effects of pollution or some other kind of environmental impact that actually an economist determined to do so might be able to measure and say, look, this is a cost that's not being paid for at the pump?
Yeah. I mean, there are actually health costs of probably more from coal than from gasoline, but nobody reports the deaths of people dying because of pollution from fossil fuels. It's not reported. People don't keep track of it, but it's in fact in the thousands per year. People are dying. It's that immediate. Again, more from coal than from gasoline. But it
is. Barclay, I realize it's probably completely unfair of me to ask you to make a wild seat of the pants estimate, but I know you well enough to know that I can at least ask you this question and see what kind of fun response I'm going to get. If gasoline were uniformly $4 a gallon across the U.S. right now, of course, prices have fallen recently, but let's work with the easy round number of $4 a gallon as what somebody is paying when they go to a pump tomorrow afternoon to fill up their car's gas tank. If we added in the hidden costs that you think are there, both that have been paid for through our tax subsidies of the oil industry, as well as what the hidden costs of the effects of pollution are, what would we pay for a gallon of gas if we actually covered those costs at the pump?
That's a very good question, and I don't have a definite answer, but I think that if you had another dollar a gallon, you probably would be covering it. That would probably more than cover it. So, want a quick answer? That
might we're paying something around 20 or 25% less a gallon if we really paid for what we're doing with that particular.
I'll go out on a limb with that, but if anybody wants to challenge me, I'll say, yeah, that's really pulled out of nowhere. But I will note that we do have estimates on more on the coal side, and the estimates in terms of, and this is strictly human health, this has nothing to do with global warming or anything like that, that the benefits of improved health from reducing certain kinds of pollutants from burning coal have been in the billions and billions of dollars per year. So they're not small numbers involved here.
Jay Barclay Rosser is a professor of economics as well as a named professor in the Business Administration Department at James Madison University. He's written extensively about the connections between economics and chaos theory, including the book From Catastrophe to Chaos, A General Theory of Economic Discontinuities. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. We're taking a look at the energy economy with Barclay's help on this edition of Virginia Insight. If you have a question or comment for us, our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Most of our questions have come in so far on Facebook, so let's get to some of these. This is Carolyn, who says, green energy needs a level playing field. This is what we were just talking about. If the true cost of oil included all the things the government now pays for, especially military involvement to secure safe oil production and passage, then green energy would be much less expensive than oil per kilowatt. It is noteworthy that countries without large standing armies, namely Germany, are the most forward in green energy. Thoughts in response to Carolyn's comments, Barclay?
I would say that I'm not sure I would tie Germany's attitude to green energy to their lack of a military. But I think the point that a tremendous amount of our military spending and activity is indeed focused and has been for several decades on securing oil supplies from the Middle East and from the Persian Gulf in particular. I mean, even right now, you know, probably one of the scariest issues that could still happen is what might happen with Iran. The most recent decline in oil prices and gasoline prices is largely probably due to the fact that negotiations have started up with Iran. And several months ago, it looked like there might be an attack on Iran, and the Iranians might shut off the Strait of Hormuz, and this could push, you know, could have pushed gasoline prices up by several dollars in a very short amount of time, and people would have been very, very unhappy. You know, many people think, why were we in Iraq? That's a complicated matter, but lots of people think it was the fundamental underlying thing was we were concerned about oil. So I think there is something to that. We are spending, there's another subsidy, if you will. We're spending an enormous amount of money. Some substantial portion of our military spending is very much focused on the Middle East and ultimately guaranteeing oil supplies.
This is from Frank, who posted to us on Facebook, where if you just joined us, I ought to mention again, we are listed as Virginia Insight. Frank says, I don't really get the idea of paying $10,000 to $15,000 more for a hybrid car. You're probably not going to make back that money in savings on gas, even if you keep the car for 5 or 6 years. Besides, aren't really expensive battery replacements going to be part of your overall cost? And aren't the type of battery used an environmental concern, too, both in their manufacture and eventual disposal?
I think here there's a lot to this question. Hybrid cars certainly are more expensive. I think that there is a justification for having some kind of subsidy for buying them. Those subsidies have actually been cut back recently. They were larger in the past. Again, based on these problems about reduced pollution and so forth. So yeah, if you just put them on a level playing field and don't have some kind of a subsidy, it's going to take a while for you to make your money back. Although again, of course, that depends on what the price of gasoline is. I'm not really going to forecast what the price of gasoline is.
But we played a little mental game.
We'll tell
people listening that we were talking about the average person driving maybe 10,000 miles a year. And if you looked at gasoline at being $4 a gallon, that somebody who had a hybrid car and that their mileage was twice as good as somebody who had an internal combustion car, the person with a hybrid would, on gasoline at 10,000 miles a year, would only be saving around $800 a year.
Right. Right.
If you're paying an extra $10,000 for a hybrid vehicle,
it's going to take a while.
It's going to take a long time at $800 a year in savings to make it up. So that's the self-interest thing, isn't it?
I mean, if that's right. But again, this depends on what the price of gasoline is going to be. And frankly, the price of gasoline could be quite different over the next few years. We really can't forecast it. There's some, you know, we are increasing production in the United States right now, and that's helping to push the price down. But some of the largest pools of oil in the world are in fact beginning to decline in their production. The Middle East is not as solid a source. We're continuing to have rising demand from China and other parts of the world. We could see prices of gasoline that are much, much higher than they are now. So that, you know, that calculus. But I would agree with Tom that, and I think Frank has a concern there. If you're doing it on strictly your own benefit at sort of current prices, it's going to be quite a while before you're going to make the money back.
What about what he says about batteries?
I think there's a different issue that we have to keep in mind, that there are really two kinds of hybrid cars, although one of them is now called an electric car. There's really two kinds of electric cars. So something like a Nissan Leaf is a purely electric car. It doesn't use any gasoline at all, and it doesn't have much of a range. But then you have something like the Chevy Volt, which I think we're going to see more of in the future. That's really a hybrid that is, it's basically an electric car, but it's got a gasoline engine backup, whereas your standard hybrid cars are really gasoline engines that have an electric backup. Your Chevy Volts, they use your batteries a lot, and they're going to have a lot of replacement. But your regular hybrid cars, they very, very infrequently will you replace the battery. So I don't think that's such a big issue for those kinds of hybrids. That might be a bigger issue for the Chevy Volt kind of car. There are issues about those batteries. Yes, they are a potential pollution problem. And another issue, which is a big problem for solar and wind and several other alternatives, is that these technologies use rare earths that are largely produced in China. And this is a serious
rare earths that are mined in areas of China. So we're dependent on China for them.
Right.
And in addition to getting you to explain more about rare earths, Barclay Rosser, I want to ask you about nuclear power and something you say should be a big deal called thorium. So we'll get to that when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. From the Department of Economics at James Madison University, Barclay Rosser is our guest. The energy economy is our topic. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And rather than my asking the question, Barclay, I think that we have a caller who's going to talk about what I was going to ask you about. I think this is Nikki in Fort Valley.
Hi.
You're on the air, Nikki. Thank you for joining
us. Hi. Thanks. Have to tell you first, I'm an NPR junkie, and Virginia Insight provides some of my most informative hours on NPR.
I love you already.
Well, I love you too. Dr. Rosser, I'm so glad that you're talking about this subject, and I'm thrilled to have somebody say something about thorium. I've been reading as much as I can about liquid fluoride thorium reactors for the past couple of years. I've had a lot of interaction with the Thorium Energy Alliance, which, you know, they've got the ultimate word. There are so many reasons why this appears to be the silver bullet to solve our energy problems, everything from the benefits of using up spent fuel from nuclear reactors, that the waste can't be converted to weapons. It's a very easily extracted resource from many sources, including coal. It can be done on a large scale or a small scale. It's very safe.
Nikki, I'm going to ask you to hold on for a second so we can back up here.
Okay.
And
she's saying everything that I was going to say.
Barclay, I'm going to depend on you to explain to us what thorium is and what it's used for.
Okay. Well, this is an alternative to uranium as a source for nuclear power. And it does have many advantages, as Nikki is saying. Another one that she hasn't mentioned is, and this is one thing that's not a silver bullet, you still have a waste disposal problem, but the half-life is only 300 years compared to several thousand years for uranium. So even on the sort of waste storage, waste disposal problem, it's much superior to uranium. So it's a source of having nuclear power. I would note that nuclear power itself, as long as you don't have radiation leaks or something, is in fact completely clean. There's no greenhouse gases. There's no sulfur dioxide, none of these other things. There's a lot more thorium around than there is uranium. Let me note two things. One is that I think there's a reason why we haven't done it. It was the U.S. in the 1950s that first figured out how to do thorium reactions. But ironically, it was this matter of that you couldn't get nuclear weapons out of it. And at that time, we wanted to have nuclear power that we could make weapons out of. And so we just did not pursue the technology. But of course, right now, that's a very appealing issue. I mean, if Iran were building thorium reactors, that would be, you know, that would be the end of that issue. Interestingly, the one country that's actually pursuing this in a serious way, it's sort of ironic, is a less developed country, is India. India is very seriously pursuing the thorium technology, and they are building thorium reactors. And I think that this is a very good thing. I mean, if you look broadly at the world, why are we going to get global warming? And we've got China and India are both massively increasing electricity production. They're both using huge amounts of coal, but the main alternative for them is not solar or wind. It's nuclear, and they're both doing some nuclear. But India's actually may well pursue this thorium path.
So, Nikki, let me check with you and our guest economist Barclay Rosser. Both is what both of you are saying is that if we focused on thorium for nuclear energy, we would solve a whole bunch of problems, including the fact that in the U.S. there's a great supply of this, and so we wouldn't be dependent on other countries for our major source of fuel.
That's certainly a big advantage, and in fact, this is probably the big advantage of thorium nuclear over solar and wind, at least our current solar and wind technologies, and for that matter, hybrid cars. All of those depend on those rare earths. Now, 1985, we produced about a third of the world's rare earth elements. But in fact, the mining process for rare earths is itself very environmentally damaging. That's why we stopped doing it. We produce almost none, although now we're beginning to work to open up some mines. The Chinese consciously went out, and they're producing 90% of it and have been using this as a weapon against Japan, for example. 90% of world production of the rare earths is coming out of China. I mean, they've got a lock hold of it.
Is that because they have more of it available?
They have more of it available, but they also very consciously went out of their way to develop this industry.
So tell us a little bit about whether, and Nikki, I realize we're getting away from thorium for a moment.
But in any case, thorium does not require that.
Tell us what a rare earth is.
Well, they are rare. They are elements. Yeah,
I got that part.
I mean, they're things
but they're
like
different kinds of elements that go into
niobium and tellurium and indium, and they are used in magnets and batteries and a variety of other things that go into a number of our very high tech industries.
So you need them for solar power.
Yeah, it's a great irony. It is probably the great irony of this whole issue that many of our probably the biggest Achilles heel of several of our major green technologies, both the hybrid cars and our photovoltaic solar panels, and also our wind energy. It's wind energy, it's magnets, require a lot of use of these rare earths. I think there's eight of them that are needed for hybrid cars. For solar panels, it's tellurium and indium, and China is the overwhelming source of these things. And we just last year there was a conflict over a fishing incident between Japan and China. The Japanese captured a Chinese boat that was in their waters, and the Chinese demanded that the Japanese release the captain. And the Chinese basically forced this by they stopped shipping rare earth elements to Japan, where they make hybrid cars, and they really put the squeeze on them. So this is a very serious issue.
So, Nikki, I'm sorry, I have to ask for explanation for so many things, but I got us away from thorium for a moment. Was the other point that you were trying to make is that you're wondering why there hasn't been more publicity or public discussion and debate about thorium-based nuclear energy?
Exactly. When you realize the benefits of it and people spend all their time talking about wind, which is great. It does have its drawbacks. But solar, it's great, but it has its drawbacks. And they both have a lot more drawbacks than thorium does. And I don't understand.
Agree or disagree with that, Barclay?
I think I actually do basically agree. I think the problem here, and it is actually, I think it's both an information issue and a psychology issue. On the information issue, people just, they just haven't heard about it. The psychology issue is that people have kind of very deep-seated fear of nuclear power, period. Yeah. I mean, we can see this with what's happened in Japan. The Fukushima, I mean, I'm afraid, frankly, that we're not going to pursue any nuclear in the U.S. because, people just say, look what happened in Japan. But what happened in Japan, the only people who died from nuclear aspect there were workers who went into the power plants to shut them down. There was absolutely no deaths due to radiation or anything else outside of the nuclear power plants themselves.
But those were uranium.
Those are uranium. Those are old, very old technology uranium plants. Japan's completely shut down all its nuclear power plants.
Barclay Rosser, if they were using thorium for those nuclear plants, would there have been less danger?
There would have been less danger. There would have been less danger. But, it's sort of I would note, by the way, also that the modern technologies, now this is not really a difference between uranium and thorium, but modern technologies of nuclear power plants use passive technologies that automatically shut down themselves. They're far, far, far safer. And in Japan, and for that matter, we haven't built any nuclear power plants here basically in 30 years, except for some additions. And so Japan and the United States both have these old technologies that are much more dangerous. They don't automatically shut down. So it would actually be a wise idea to just go replace the ones we have with passive technologies, preferably using thorium, that would have these other advantages over uranium. So, but people are so afraid of nuclear, it's sort of like they don't even want to hear about it. It's just
Nikki, I've already told you that I love you, but I really love your question. You really got us going. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm just thrilled to talk about it, and I thank Dr. Rosser so much I had more questions, and you answered them all.
You're welcome.
So you must be psychic. And I think the biggest thing, my feeling is that we need to tell people how safe it really is. because right now there is yet another uranium plant that is being built. And, you know, somehow that got done. Why aren't we jumping on this bandwagon? Why aren't our legislators talking about it? So that's my platform. And the more we can do, the more you can do, the better.
Nikki, thanks so much for sharing your perspective. 888-WMRA Talk is our phone number, 888-967-2825. If you have any suggestions, thoughts, ideas, questions about economics and energy, economist J. Barclay Rosser Jr. from James Madison University is here to discuss the energy economy. Here we have on Facebook from Barry a really long post. Barry, I'm only going to be able to get to a little bit of it, but anybody who wants to look online is welcome to read all of your thoughts here. Part of what Barry says is the popular narrative about how far in the future clean energy will be cost effective is way off, especially as it concerns solar. Most folks seem to presume that we are still decades away from tipping the cost balance, but that's not true. We're there right now. And the reason is the exponential growth of technologies. Moore's law dictates that the price performance of computing technologies doubles roughly every 14 to 16 months, and solar energy panels are on that curve. It's why the cell phone in our pockets are 1 million times cheaper and 1,000 times more powerful than the supercomputers of the 1960s. Any thoughts in response to Barry's claims?
Okay, well, kind of two different directions. One, it is true that the cost of solar is dropping. It's still substantially more. So, for example, right now to produce a megawatt hour of electricity, conventional coal is $94, basically about $95. Natural gas is the lowest, which is the one that's coming on with $66. And solar photovoltaics are still over $200. But the price is dropping and dropping fairly sharply. And much of this is also because of the Chinese massively subsidizing this industry in their country. But I would disagree with Barry on, I don't think that Moore's law applies to this technology. Moore's law does apply to computers. But this is not, these solar panels are not computers. It's a different kind of technology. And so I'm less optimistic about that we're going to see this kind of rapid rate of decline. The main source of the decline in solar panel costs is because of falling costs of polysilicon, which is probably the number one material input. So that cost is dropping. I am hopeful about solar. I'd like to see more solar. I think the way we need to view this is there's both input and output issues in terms of energy. So ultimately, solar is probably better than thorium because the input is the sun, which is not going away. Thorium will eventually run out of. And the output is completely clean. Okay, and again, we've got some issues about waste disposal and so on with thorium. They're not as bad as uranium. But it's the intermediate technology. It's the panels themselves. They've got these rare earths that you need, which those are going to go up in cost. So that's going to offset this falling cost thing. And then there's also disposal of them. I mean, the earlier question was, what about batteries from hybrid cars? Well, there's also an issue about disposing of solar panels. So solar in the long run is really wonderful if we can get there. But we've got some. There are problems. And I'm not as optimistic about the Moore's law projection as Barry is.
So just in the nature of widening the subject a bit to you on the other side of your radio, I'm curious, what's the lowest price you can remember ever seeing on a gasoline pump for the cost of a gallon of gas? Yeah, we're really stretching your memory, aren't we there, Barclay? If you account for inflation, how would that price compare to the prices that you see today? Do you think that we're paying for gasoline, what we're paying for gasoline today is fair? Should it be less? Should it be more? 888-WMRA-TALK is our phone number, 888-967-2825. Susan in Harrisonburg, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for economist Barclay Rosser, please.
First of all, it's a very interesting show. I really appreciate you putting on such interesting shows.
Well, thank you very much, but Barkley tends to be that way, whatever we ask him to talk about.
My question is, I've been hearing a lot of different things about the Fukushima Daiichi, whatever, nuclear power plant situation, and that it faded from the most news, and then I hear, you know, different things that it's not safe, that it's, you know, there's just all kinds of rumors swirling. I'll take my answer off the air if you have any opinion or...
And this is the one in Japan?
Yes.
What's happened in Japan?
Caused as a result of the earthquake.
You had the tsunami hit the Fukushima plant, and essentially what's happened, and one can say this is sort of unreasonable, but at the same time, given Japan's unfortunate history as being the only nation that was attacked by with nuclear weapons, they more than probably any country in the world has, I would say, legitimate reason to be afraid of radiation and afraid of nuclear. It's amazing in some respects that they relied as much as they did on nuclear power. They had an enormous amount of it. But they have shut down every single nuclear power plant in Japan. There will probably be zero nuclear power in Japan. They've just shut it all down. And they are now importing oil and other, you know, coal to replace.
But Barkley, I think what Susan is asking, and Susan, please check in with me about this, is what's the factual story about how safe or unsafe the power plants that were affected by the earthquake? How much danger did there turn out to be?
There was not very much danger from... Basically, it was Fukushima. Fukushima broke down its functioning, but there was
There was radiation released. There was evacuation around
but
the area.
No, the only people who, as they say, there were people who died, but they were workers. There were workers who went into the plant to completely shut it down. Again, this is a very old technology. It's not one of these passive technologies that newer plants have. So it had they had to go in and shut it down. There was a problem. There was radiation leakage, although I think part of the problem with that is that people have confused the deaths from the tsunami with the death with the nuclear power plant. That, you know, lots and lots of people died. There was huge amounts of damage, but it was basically all because it was all from the tsunami, from the floodwaters. But people have it sort of in their mind that, oh my God, this nuclear power plant broke down and the world came to an end. But, you know, the damage and the deaths were, except for these handful of people who went in to shut down the plant, it was all the floods.
No, what I'm really concerned about is the still unspent or spent fuel rods that are 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 stories off the ground in that pool that are still sitting there in a very unsafe building.
Well, I think they're just going to seal all that off is what's going to happen. I don't think, you know, it's like Chernobyl. What do you do? Chernobyl was the worst nuclear disaster we ever had in terms of a power plant. I mean, lots of people actually did die from that one. I mean, that was really bad. But, you know, what essentially they happened, they just tombed the whole thing over. I suspect that's what they're going to do there. They're just going to put a concrete tomb over the thing, and it's just, you know, I mean, it's a mess, and they're probably never going to. We've got some nuclear messes in this country. I mean, people don't really think about it, but Hanford, Washington, this was the original place where we were producing nuclear materials for our nuclear weapons program, you know, back in the 1940s. And we did not have any kind of safety. We were just storing stuff in vats. And we're spending about $1 billion a year trying to clean that up. And it's still, I mean, basically you just don't want to go near that spot. I mean, we've got a very dirty spot in the U.S. And, you know, we don't talk about it, but it's there.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. We have a question here from Jim asking if you would go into further detail on the problems that we might see if we used more thorium for nuclear power. You can hear the music. I just put that out there so you can think about it, Barkley Rosser, for about a minute before we get back from the break, and then we're going to continue with our discussion here about the energy economy on Virginia Insight. Barkley Rosser is a professor of economics as well as a named professor in the Business Administration Department at James Madison University. He's written extensively about connections between economics and chaos theory, including his book From Catastrophe to Chaos. He also travels the world talking about economics. Most recently, he's just back from a couple of conferences in Moscow. So we're very happy to have him back in the Insight Studios. And before he travels to someplace else on the globe, you've got about 10 more minutes to get a call into him on our topic of the energy economy. The phone number again is 888-WMRA Talk, or if you prefer to type instead of talk on the phone, you can post to us on our Virginia Insight Facebook page, which again, Barkley, is what Jim did, saying, in essence, got to be more problems about thorium. Talk about those.
Okay. Well, I think the ones that haven't been discussed, I mean, there are problems. Again, you do have the waste disposal problem, which you have with uranium, but it's not nearly as serious. So that's probably, I think, the worst. The other problems are that, well, nuclear is a bit more expensive. Conventional nuclear, the page I had is about $113. It's a bit more, that's compared to 95 for coal. It's a little bit more expensive than coal. It's definitely more expensive than natural gas. So, you know, those plants are big. They take a long time to build. So there's a big upfront cost. So there's just simply a cost issue, although they're not as expensive as some of the other alternatives like solar. The other really big problem, and this kind of gets back to sort of Nikki's concerns, is we don't have the technology fully developed to just pull it off the shelf. We really, I mean, this goes back to the 1950s. We basically decided, because we wanted to have a nuclear power source that would allow us to build weapons, we just stopped developing the technology to, you know, just to put these up. We have off-the-shelf technology for building uranium nuclear reactors. That sort of really needs to be developed still for thorium. So it's not something we're just going to be, it's not something we're gonna, it's, that's going to solve our problems tomorrow. We've really got to kind of develop this technology. And to the extent that everybody's sitting around shaking their heads and saying, we don't want any nuclear, we're not going to do it. I mean, as I noted, the people who are doing it are the Indians. You know, we may have to wait for India to develop
it. India.
Yeah. We may have to get them to develop the technology that then we can take off the shelf. So really the biggest problem may be that it's just not really ready to go, you know, bingo like that. Down the longer haul, I think it's a great technology, but we've kind of got to develop it so that it's commercially viable.
To you who are listening, how much of your budget goes for paying for the cost of energy? Have you come across any energy-related costs in your life that you think most people have never considered? 888-WMRA Talk is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. Dave in Charlottesville, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for economist Barkley Rosser, please.
My comment?
Sure.
Okay. Well, it's just you asked about the price of energy. I remember distinctly in 1967 seeing gasoline for 18.9 in the St. Louis area, and my family went on a family vacation to New Orleans, and it was around 18 to 20 throughout our vacation that year. I haven't done the statistics to figure out, you know, how much that would be worth in today's money. But it seems like it was a bargain then, and it's no longer a bargain.
Yeah, 19 cents a gallon in 1967.
Yeah, that's still under a dollar in today's. That's less than a dollar in today's prices, yeah.
And
80, 90 cents a gallon now, today's prices.
It seems to me, because I was looking up some numbers. And Dave, do you remember how old you were when this family journey was being made?
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Do you remember how old you were when this family trip was underway?
Yes, I was 12 years old.
Ah, okay. Because I was looking up some of the government's computation on inflation and past gas prices, and got the average price of gasoline in 1960 as being 31 cents a gallon. So it sounds like in 67, Dave's family was finding a really great bargain.
That's a bargain.
Well, it was called a gas war. They used to have the gas wars.
Yeah.
When stations would compete against each other to get your business. Those are long gone.
I think we got one going on right now here in Harrisonburg. We got prices at $3.05, and that's a good 20 cents below what it is anywhere around us. I think there's a little bit of a gas we're going right this moment in Harrisonburg. You're right. You don't see them too much, though.
Dave, thanks for sharing that memory with us.
Thank you.
So in terms of the fluctuation of gas prices, are U.S. consumers at the mercy of some forces we simply don't understand? And if we did understand them, we could control them better?
No, not really. Here's the problem. We're in a global market. It's supply and demand. There's really nobody. You know, OPEC at one point was maybe in control, but they're not really in control anymore. There's nobody really controlling this. It's a huge global market. Many suppliers, many demanders. Here is really the problem, though. We our usage, it's very hard for us to cut back much in the short run. The long run, yeah, we can adjust, but we're locked into our travel schedules. We regular times we drive and so on and so on and so on. So when we run out of inventories, when there's a sudden shortage, the price can just shoot way up very sharply, very suddenly. And in fact, this has been, if you look over the really long
history. So that's a supply and demand.
It's a supply and demand. I mean, we've had occasional periods.
You were talking a little while ago about the scare over Iran that started a little bit less than a year ago. Wasn't much of the increase in the world price of gasoline then simply a matter of speculation?
Buying
gasoline.
You've got more speculators, but this was a reasonable thing. People were worried we weren't able to get gas. So what are they doing? They're buying it to pile up in inventories in case it shoots up in the future. So that's, the speculation increases the volatility a little bit, but we've always had highly volatile prices of oil. This goes all the way back. Goes all the way back into the 19th century. You have long periods of time and prices are stable, and then you have these huge spikes that go up. So it's volatility of the price of oil is not something new. It's a little bit more volatile because of the speculation, but not. I would say in 2008. Then I think speculation 2008 maybe have pushed the price up a bit higher than it would have been without the speculation. But it was perfectly rational to worry about there being a shortage of oil if there was a war in Iran. I mean, that's a completely rational fear. And that probably added about $15 to the world price of oil. And that's now gone away again since that fare has been reduced for the moment.
As far as I know, they have not mentioned thorium, but the Obama administration has been saying that it is taking an all-of-the-above approach to future energy production in the U.S., and yes, that includes nuclear power. So I'm asking you on the other side of your radio, do you have an opinion on whether expanding the use of nuclear energy in the U.S. is a good idea, or do you think it's a bad idea? For just a couple more minutes, we've got a phone line open here for you to talk with us. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Our guest, economist J. Barclay Rosser, Jr. Phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. This from Carol on Facebook, who says, how much of the oil produced globally goes into energy? What percentage? And how much goes into manufactured goods like vinyl and fertilizer? Great question.
Yeah, that's a very good question. But it's overwhelmingly energy. That other is less than 2%. So it's, in fact, more on the order of 1%. But yes, there is quite a bit going into fertilizer. There is quite a bit going into plastics and so on. So, but that's a very small minority. The overwhelming majority is energy.
So by shopping at stores that don't use plastic bags and staying away from plastic bags, I'm really not having that much effect on petroleum.
Not too much.
It the waste stream, I suppose.
Right. I think the issue there is worrying about the outside, the waste, rather than what's going on.
Well, we haven't talked much about conservation. Is that a realistic element of what you think needs to be built into the future of energy policy?
Yes. But of course, the only way you really get people to conserve is to raise the price, which people don't like. I mean, we see it right now in political races. All the candidates, when they're faced by voters, say, I'm going to lower the price of gasoline. But that does not lead to conservation. You can order people to do things, but that's not the way we do things in this country. It's when the prices go up, then people will conserve. So I hate to be, but that's the way it is. So conservation, people only go there when they really feel like they must. And that's that. But conservation would be great, but that gets us back to how much are we, how much of a high price do we want to face for these things?
So getting back to Dave's recollection of the 19 cents a gallon his family was paying when they were driving around the Midwest back in 1967, it seems to me that I've heard you talk about something that was going on in the 60s and 50s and 40s having to do with tax policy that has an influence on our energy policy today. And this had something to do with oil wells, Barclay?
Yeah. This was the oil depletion allowance. I would note underlying this was that all the way up to the 1950s, we were a net oil exporter. We were the we were the OPEC of the world. The Texas Railroad Commission controlled, to the extent there was a control of world prices, it was the Texas Railroad Commission controlled the number of days that oil could be pumped in Texas, and that was sort of the OPEC. But in the 50s, that balance shifted, and we became a net importer. So we didn't control things anymore. But we had a big expansion of oil production, and it was subsidized. And the oil depletion allowance, it was the rich person's tax loophole.
Was an oil depletion allowance?
If you owned an oil well, and the oil was being pumped, you could write off the value of that oil against your income. So in the 1950s, the top marginal income tax rate was over 90%. You're a high-income person. This was the great tax loophole.
So if you had an income of $1 million a year, on at least some of that income, you were paying what you were supposed to pay before loopholes, 90%.
That's right. So how did you get around that? So how do you lower that? Well, you go out and buy yourself or get yourself in some firm that owns a bunch of oil wells, and then you could start, you know, counting, knocking off from your income the pumping of the oil out of the depletion.
So does that work out to, in essence, the U.S. government was paying you to pump oil
out
of wells?
That's right. And indeed, it's kind of, you know, it's sort of ironic that you know, in the late 50s, there was an effort to keep out oil imports. And they said, oh, it's going to damage the domestic industry. But of course, what was going on is we were just pumping oil even faster. When we kept out the foreign oil, we just pumped our own oil faster. So it was kind of a silly policy all the way around.
Phone number is 888-WMRA Talk. Chad, thanks for calling in. Chad, where are you calling from?
From Charlottesville.
Thanks for doing that. Your question or comment for Barclay Rosser, please.
So I heard the word taxes, and then earlier there was a caller who talked about cheap fuel, and I was wondering if you might direct your comments to the state of Virginia, where our state tax on gasoline, along with the federal tax on gasoline, hasn't been adjusted for inflation for 10, 20 years, whatever the number is. I think it would be about double what we're paying now, and at the same time, we're barely collecting enough money to maintain our roads, and in fact, the most current budgets are moving money around, taking money from education and healthcare to pay for road maintenance. And,
Chad, I'm so glad that you called on this subject because I get a chance to show off. We just had a show recently on Virginia politics, and it was underscored that the last time Virginia's gas tax, the state tax on gasoline, was raised was 1986. And since 1986, it has stayed at 17.5 cents a gallon. Interestingly, our Republican governor has recently proposed that the gas tax be tied to inflation, which many conservatives don't like. But
let me add something here. This goes broader than, I think we should have a higher gas tax, and we've got some severe transportation needs. But a broader issue, when people talk about, say, a carbon tax or raising taxes on some sort, you know, fossil fuels, usually what people have suggested is, look, you can, if you want to not have an overall tax increase, what you can do is you can offset that with a cut in income taxes. So most of the people who have supported some kind of a higher gas or carbon tax haven't said, okay, you can offset that. And there have been a number of Republican economists. I would know Gregory Mankiw, who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for a period of time under George W. Bush. He has supported a carbon tax. And the argument is, okay, you raise that, you get more money out of that, you know, so people will use less oil and you can pay for your highways and other transportation. But at the same time, you could then lower other kinds of taxes, income taxes and so forth.
Chad,
just mention that, but I guess a point not to be lost is when people think about the glory days of when gas was 19 cents or 27 cents and gee, how cheap it was. Let's not forget that we still have to maintain roads, and the fact that we want cheap gas is not keeping up with our need to maintain our infrastructure, and that, you know, we wish to win on one side, and yet we're losing on the other.
Well, Chad, the other thing that it occurs to me to mention is a few weeks ago, the Virginian Pilot daily newspaper, which of course serves the eastern coast, the Hampton Roads area, featured a series of stories about some studies comparing the cost of gasoline to motorists in North Carolina versus the cost of gasoline to motorists in Virginia, in part because the gas tax in North Carolina is twice what it is in Virginia. It's 35 cents a gallon. And the bottom line of what the Virginian Pilot reported is, on average, a motorist in North Carolina pays for gas at the pump 2 cents a gallon more than in Virginia. So where does that other 33 cents go? And the Pilot, in its editorial pages, was making the point that it felt that the profits are 33 cents a gallon higher in Virginia for oil companies, and that market forces keep the price about equivalent from state to state, so that if the gas tax was raised in Virginia, it wouldn't make that much difference in terms of what motorists saw at the pump. You have any feelings about that theory, Chad?
No, I don't. It's an interesting one, but maybe somebody from the Petroleum Marketers Association would care to call in and take that one on.
Well, we'll have to wait for them to call next time, because we're just about out of time now. Chad, thank you so much for joining us. You got 15 seconds for a final observation, if you care to make one, Barclay Rosser, about the
energy economy. Well, I'll just notice one issue we didn't talk much about, which is wind. And I note that wind is currently competitive on prices with coal, and I would sort of like to see more of it, but it also has the problem of people don't like them, and they've got the rare earth problem,
and
too.
And it kills birds and bats.
And it kills birds and bats, especially the bats are a problem. Yep.
Our guest has been J. Barclay Rosser, Professor of Economics, and the Kirby L. Kramer Professor of Business Administration at James Madison University. Barclay, so good to see you again. Thanks for your time.
A pleasure.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. If you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work Dr. Rosser is doing. And if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, well, you get access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.